KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, laurelhursttheater.com.
The time is 5 o'clock, and coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland. Printed Oregon and Multnomah County nonpartisan voters' guides in English and Spanish are available in many locations, including all branches of the Multnomah County Library and online at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, all charges against Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman over the Dakota Access Pipeline protest were dropped earlier today.
A new legal analysis issued by the Oregon Legislative Council finds that a ban on residential no-fault evictions would contradict state law and be unenforceable.
And live in our studio, we'll be speaking with Andrew Jankowski of the Lippmann Gallery and artist Evan Wellington about the art show Camp Here Tonight.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 17th, 2016. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Ken Jones. A North Dakota judge rejected charges against Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman Monday. Goodman returned to the state to continue coverage of the Dakota Access resistance camps and to face legal action against her. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Crowds gathered outside the Mandan, North Dakota courthouse Monday afternoon as prominent journalist Amy Goodman appeared before a judge. A phalanx of police, clad in riot gear and carrying batons, stood poised along the sidewalk. At least one person was arrested. Goodman returned to the state to face charges related to the Democracy Now! Team's coverage of the Standing Rock Sioux resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. After the judge rejected the riot charges, she emerged from the courthouse and said she felt vindicated.
Standing up for freedom of the press goes beyond journalism. Freedom of the press is about the public's right to know. Mm-hmm. That right to know is sacred. That's what makes a democracy meaningful, when you are able to make informed decisions. We've got to open up the media to everyone's voice. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe that we all sit around and debate and discuss the critical issues of the day.
Goodman continued, explaining why she thinks elevating the voices of those often ignored and unheard is vital.
When you hear someone speak for themselves, a Lakota grandmother, an Ojibwe grandchild, it breaks down barriers. It challenges the caricatures and stereotypes that fuel the hate groups. It is so important that we open up this dialogue. You don't have to agree with what you hear, but you begin to understand where people are coming from. That's the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Unfortunately, all too often it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back.
In early September, a Democracy Now! Crew traveled to the resistance camps and protests to document the growing movement against the pipeline. While there, they filmed a private security company unleashing attack dogs on water and land protectors. 5 days later, North Dakota State's Attorney Ladd Erickson filed criminal trespass charges against the 30-year media veteran. Those charges were dropped last week, but new charges were announced Friday: rioting. The Democracy Now! Video of the violent showdown went viral and was picked up by corporate media.
CBS Evening News, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, NPR. And it went on from there. We call that trickle-up journalism. The state cannot stop this journalism. The state must not stop this journalism. Violating the First Amendment is not good for North Dakota. It's not good for this country.
If completed, the nearly $4 billion project would carry 500,000 barrels of crude oil from the Bakken oil fields to a transfer station in Illinois. The D.C. Circuit Court has twice refused to grant the tribe an injunction halting work on the contested section of the pipeline. But almost immediately after each ruling, the federal government issued an unprecedented three-agency statement in which the Interior, Justice, and Army departments have asked the developer, Energy Transfer Partners, to voluntarily stop work, a request the company has not honored. Goodman is not the only journalist who's been arrested during actions opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline. Multiple reporters with the independent media collective Unicorn Riot have been jailed in recent weeks. An award-winning documentary filmmaker, Daya Schlossberg, has been charged with three felonies and faces up to 45 years in prison. Nell Abram, FSRN.
In addition to Amy Goodman, documentary filmmaker and journalist Daya Schlossberg was arrested in North Dakota last week. However, Schlossberg has yet to be released. She was taken into custody for filming activists protesting against the Dakota Access Pipeline in Walhalla, North Dakota. Schlossberg is charged with three felonies: conspiracy to theft of property, conspiracy to theft of services, and conspiracy to tampering with or damaging a public service. If convicted of all three charges, Schlossberg could face up to 45 years in prison. When arrested last Tuesday, the filmmaker was held without access to a lawyer for 48 hours, and her film footage was confiscated by police. Among other filmmakers and journalists cited as part of the protest, actress Shailene Woodley was also arrested for live streaming a prayer action at a Dakota Access Pipeline construction site. The protest in North Dakota was part of a four-state effort by activists to shut down the pipelines carrying tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, into the United States. The protest resulted from a call by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and members of over 200 other tribes from across the United States, Canada, and Latin America for action on the growing climate emergency. You can sign a letter of support for Daya Schlossberg online at howtoletgomovie.com.
The Arizona Republic newspaper last month broke a 125-year tradition by endorsing the Democratic candidate for president, Hillary Clinton. In response, the paper's reporters, editors, other staff, even people selling subscriptions door-to-door, have been the targets of abuse. That abuse has escalated to bomb threats and other death threats. The Republic is standing its ground, publishing a dignified and defiant editorial on Sunday. Journalists around the world are expressing support for the Arizona Republic using the Twitter hashtag First Amendment.
According to a new legal analysis issued by the Oregon Legislative Council, instituting a ban on no-fault evictions in the city of Portland would contradict state law and be unenforceable. Rental prices have skyrocketed over the last few years amid the population boom and tight rental market, causing a housing affordability crisis and prompting the Portland City Council to officially declare a housing emergency. One tactic the city council was considering was banning, quote, quote, no-cause evictions, in which the landlord evicts a tenant in order to significantly raise the rent for the new tenant. However, a new analysis by the Oregon Legislative Council concluded the ban would violate state law and an amendment would be required. Both Portland Mayor-elect Ted Wheeler and Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the House for the Oregon State Legislature, have stated they would support changing the law to allow banning no-cause evictions. The Oregon Legislature next session starts in February of 2017.
Camp Here Tonight, the new art show at Portland State University's Littman Gallery, encourages art fans to think about breaking the law by helping houseless people find a dry place to lay their heads. We spoke last week with artist Wendy Dyer about how the show came together. This week, we speak to more of the people who made the show happen. We're joined tonight by artist Evan Wellington and Andrew Jankowski of the Littman Gallery. Evan and Andrew, thanks for coming in tonight.
Thanks so much.
Hey, Andrew, let's start with you first. For people who haven't been to the gallery to see the show yet, can you describe the exhibit?
Absolutely. There are several multicolored Technicolor tarp quilt tents that are, I believe they range from, they can range from 8 to 12 feet in height. There are four of them set up in the gallery right now, along with a multimedia display pertaining to the artist and her previous experiences with homelessness, or houselessness, rather. And she also set up a kind of a mock-up of her workstation that includes her sewing machine and her tables and the equipment that she uses. And it takes up the entirety of the Littman Gallery.
And that artist is Wendy Dyer?
That's correct, yes.
And Evan, your work is also exhibited there, too. You're part of Wendy's exhibit?
It was a collaboration. Mm-hmm. I'm a steel fabricator, and I'm also an organizer with Portland Tenants United. Wendy and I met at a action in May outside of the award ceremony hosted by Multifamily Northwest, the housing association that represents landlord industry and that plays an integral part in the inflation of rents that we see today. And so when we met, later on she learned I was a steel fabricator, and she had already had the concept in mind for this show, and it was a quite natural symbiotic collaboration.
Did you guys then kind of brainstorm it into its final form and then approach Andrew with the idea?
I believe she had already reached out to the Littman Gallery, and it, you know, everything as far as our collaboration had to do with actually getting it done, what the specifications of the tents were, et cetera.
What were the initial objectives of the exhibit? It's obviously there's a motivation there to get people, I think, to see the houseless as people rather than these kind of faceless masses that we read about on the news.
Yes, definitely. It's an important issue, and this is an exhibition that aims to highlight it in a way that also seeks to humanize the plight of those people who are, you know, facing the front lines of this crisis. We have a shortage of about 25,000, according to 25,000 affordable housing units in Portland, where even the eligibility for affordable housing surpasses that supply, according to the city. And so for those who are actually living on the streets or having to find, you know, having to find shelters, this is something that aims to both show that struggle and also offer offer people who actually have the means to live in a house to think about ways to offer solutions outside of, you know, what may necessarily be above board avenues.
And Andrew, how did you get involved? Evan said that Wendy had approached you earlier before she started collaborating with Evan.
Yeah, that's probably correct. I joined the Littman White Gallery staff in May of this year, and before my joining of the staff, the kind of the groundwork had already been laid for Wendy to come into our gallery. She'd been working with a curator who I believe has since moved on from the gallery, but she's been working with our current co-curator. We have two curators between the galleries, and she's been working with one of them. He didn't really have a lot of involvement with the show to begin with, but he has really done a great job in like coming in and like balancing what our gallery's needs are with what like Wendy and her team's needs are. And he's just been really fabulous at making that happen.
And this is really not a kind of show that you just go and you watch. It's somewhat interactive.
It is interactive, yeah. It's not necessarily like going into, like, you know, the Portland Art Museum and looking at paintings. It's
You're not allowed to touch anything.
No, yeah, not there. No. But I mean, here we really invite people to really get immersive with the exhibit. You can actually get inside of the tents, and you get like a completely different perspective. When you're in them versus, like, you know, just outside looking at them, you have to kind of like get in the headspace of what if this was, like, you know, if this was the thing that was going to keep me safe and sheltered. And then another thing that I think you would really have to be there to take away is just, we have these floodlights that we're using to illuminate the gallery. And at night, it's such an interesting feeling, like, to look at the gallery. It has this very, like, enchanting sort of like cozy feel that you can get just by looking at it. But the thing about tarp is, like, it doesn't keep you warm. It doesn't, it's not very comforting. So it's just a very odd, like, juxtaposition between, like, that sort of fantasy and reality. But it gets really warm in the gallery too. That's just a thing I was not expecting. I was documenting the show one night and I was just like, by the end, I was just out of breath. And
because
sweating.
You have all those lights.
Yeah.
One of the things that Wendy talked about when we were interviewing her was that when you put a light inside tarp, the light shines through and it makes almost a stained glass effect.
Yeah.
And, you know, traditionally in cathedrals like Notre Dame, that was supposed to be a safe place for people to be. So in the, I'm not asking anybody about, like, religious imagery or the sense of what it, what's the word I'm looking for, a safe place to be, but it looks like you're kind of playing with this concept of what's safe. What do we think is safe from the person to live with you, and maybe it's not safe and stuff like that. As I wanted to ask you this question, as you're looking at this show, and the Littman Gallery is basically in current, we haven't talked about the signs yet either.
That's correct.
But but we'll talk a little bit more about what's interactive. But one of the things that, as Ken was saying, when you read the daily newspaper's coverage, almost all the reader comments were a fear of crime. And, you know, we've had Portland Tenants United on this show many times talking about who is the homeless in Oregon. Who are the homeless people? So can you talk a little bit about, like, what is the interactive, even more of the interactive aspect of the show? And can you just talk about that issue of, like, even reading an article about this show stressed people out and made them feel like they could be victimized by crime? Can you just dig into that a little bit?
Well, I would say, I mean, you know, seeing comment threads on papers, it's nothing new, you know, to see things that are sometimes reasonable, sometimes not so reasonable. You know, this show is about double standards, one part of it, plain and simple. And so a part of the immersive experience is, you know, not only the tents, but we have actual listings that, you know, that are copies of
Airbnb listings, where Airbnb is renting tents for $80 a night out there.
Airbnb tent rentals, which is not legal. However, you know, some do it. And
the city's not sweeping out all of the Airbnb tent rental. I didn't mean to step on you, but that's the most important part. The city's sweeping the people with nothing, but not the Airbnb people.
Exactly. And, you know, the Housing Bureau Director, Kurt Kreger, estimates just 1/3 of all Airbnb rentals deplete Portland's affordable housing stock to a net loss of $380 million. And so you can look at that, the rentals of Airbnb tents in people's yards, and the fact that enforcing regulations as far as housing is concerned with these industries coming into Portland is not emphasized. However, does the city emphasize sweeping the homeless? Yes, they do. You can look at temporary tents that are set up, you know, when there's a fair going by downtown, and, you know, that's allowed. And so all of this just flies in the face of where the priorities lie. I would like to mention that it's definitely something I would like to see happen, and I'm sure others would agree with me, as far as allowing, as far as those willing to take on the issue of homelessness in ways that are creative, in ways that are sustainable, and in ways that are safe, and if they feel comfortable with it. If somebody is able to donate their yard or their lot for an RV or for tents, that is a restriction that should be eased. And I would call on our city councilors to consider that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Evan, I'm interested. Lisa mentioned some of those comments in the Oregonian, and some of them are highly charged, very emotional. I would imagine you as an artist would not be very much against that. I mean, it's not the kind of exhibit where people go in and know how nice the tarp, the metal. Maybe making people uncomfortable is part of the exhibit, the objective.
On the other hand, I think the tents are very neat, and so, you know, I think that a part of the double standard is also about, you know, what is acceptable to you, and is it something that is looking at things through a lens of what's cosmetically convenient, or is it something that's looking, you know, through a lens of what's actually sustainable and what the issues actually are and how they need to be handled in a humanitarian way.
Oh, Evan, thanks very much. And Andrew, thanks very much for coming in. I want to ask one last question. We just have about a half minute left, but where can KBOO listeners go to find out more about the exhibit?
To find out more information about this exhibit, listeners can tune, not tune in, go to the LippmanWhite.tumblr.com. It's our official website, and we're also all over social media channels, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, where you'll be able to find information and engage with hashtags that push the conversation further.
And we're going to have the interview that we did with Wendy Dyer, who was one of the people who thought up this show. We're going to have it in full later this week so that people can get a full sense of this amazing show. We've been talking with Evan Wellington and Andrew Jankowski. Camp Here Tonight is on display through October 27th at Portland State University's Littman Gallery. That's room 250 on the second floor of the Smith Memorial Student Union. The Smith Union, of course, is at 1825 Southwest Broadway. And those hours are Monday through Friday, noon to 4 p.m. Thanks so much for being...
Actually, I'm sorry, we've just changed our hours.
Okay.
Our hours are actually Monday through Wednesday, 12 to 5, and Thursday and Friday, 12 to 6. So you get a little bit more interaction.
That's awesome. And so keep listening to KBOO News for more about this amazing show.
Let's win!
One more time. One, two, three.
Let's win!
In the fading early...
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a report on the Women in Prison Conference held at Lewis and Clark College Law School last weekend. At 6, it's Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, presenting a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and challenging the status quo. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, views and news from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, showers likely, mostly cloudy, with a low around 51. Chance of precipitation is 70%. Tomorrow, showers likely, mainly after 11 a.m., mostly cloudy, with a high near 59. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Today in history, in 1968, Olympic gold medalist Tommy Smith and bronze medalist John Carlos were stripped of their awards because they raised their fists in a Black Power salute during the medal ceremony. And in 1973, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, cut oil exports to the U.S. and other nations that were providing military aid to Israel in the Yom Kippur War. The quote of the day is from Oscar Wilde, who once said, "The books that the world calls immoral are books that shows the world its own shame." The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization released a report Monday saying that global food insecurity and climate change are linked. Without urgent action in the small-scale agricultural sector that supports sustainable practices and access to both technologies and markets, the FAO warns that another 40 million people worldwide could be food insecure by 2050. While the FAO report focuses on so-called smallholders, or local farmers and fishermen in developing nations already food insecure, strategies to encourage carbon majors to curb emissions are going before voters in the U.S. The state of Washington could become the first state in the nation to enact a carbon tax on big polluters if grassroots activists can overcome opposition from unlikely allies, the business community, low-income and people of color communities, the state Democratic Party, and environmental groups. Supporters of the carbon tax, Initiative 732, are pulling out all the stops to win voters before November. Martha Baskin with Free Speech Radio News has more.
Initiative that would tax carbon to fight climate change rally. Long summer days have turned to fall, leaving only a short window to influence voters before the November election. Ben Selesky is a 20-something organizer who's been registering voters as well as winning over hearts and minds on college campuses. He says the biggest challenge isn't convincing people that climate change is real or swaying polluters opposed to taxing carbon. It's the pace at which the clock, an ecological clock, is counting down.
When you talk to a young person about this, you know, they grew up with this issue as a storm cloud over their future. You know, they don't need to be convinced this is a serious issue. They just need to be convinced that this is a solution that's up to the scale of the problem, which it is.
But the solution Selesky and others hope voters approve is not universally supported among those who agree that action to address climate change is imperative.
Carbon taxes are kind of a wonky new frontier of solutions that even people in the environmental community don't talk about that much.
Experts say the tax would be the most aggressive tax on coal, oil, and natural gas in the nation. It would start at $25 a metric ton of carbon dioxide and eventually grow to more than $100 a ton over 40 years. This translates to about 15 cents more a gallon at the pump, a cost which the ballot measure would offset by a cut of 1% in the state's sales tax, considered among the highest in the nation. Environmental economist Yoram Bauman came up with the carbon tax, known as Initiative 732, while teaching at the University of Washington and studying a similar tax in British Columbia.
Economists like myself, we really seek putting a price on carbon as sort of the holy grail for tackling climate change.
In other words, use the market to force polluters to think about climate change every time they make an economic decision.
And that's going to have huge power in terms of moving our economy, moving our society in the direction of conservation, innovation, developing new technologies, the things that we need to do in order to fight climate change.
But the state Democratic Party, environmental groups, and several climate justice and immigrant rights coalitions actively oppose the initiative. They want economic equity and climate justice front and center. Yet they haven't put forth an alternative that would be cash positive and address issues like low-wage jobs, clean energy alternatives, racism, and environmental justice.
We were not included in this policy. There was no racial justice analysis in this policy to account for that harm that is projected.
That's Jill Mongaliman with Got Green, a grassroots group that works for an equitable and green economy to fight poverty and climate change. The problem with the carbon tax, she says, is if approved, it would be a financial wash that lets polluters pass down the cost to consumers who already bear a heavy burden. Mongaliman says the carbon tax initiative is as unfair as the state's regressive tax system, which relies on sales and real property taxes in lieu of an income tax.
Who's going to pay for it? It's going to be these communities who are already disproportionately impacted.
But proponents of the measure note that on top of a cut in the state sales tax, the carbon tax would also fund the state's working family tax rebate for the first time by giving 460,000 low-income families in the state up to $1,500 a year in tax relief. Jason Purikal, who identifies as a person of color with immigrant parents from Southeast Asia, knows affordable housing, living wage jobs, transportation, and racism are huge problems in the state. But he says the tax is a first step. He was on staff with the initiative last year and continues to volunteer.
We have to be careful of saying it's communities of color or people of color because I'm a person of color and I'm in support of I-732, right?
Purikal co-authored a recent op-ed in a local online news magazine, Crosscut, in favor of the tax.
We're coming close to a deadline of this tipping point, right? And so when is the next viable time that we'll be able to pass legislation to move things forward? Will it be 2018, 2020?
back at the pro-carbon tax rally, signature gatherer Terry Seuss sums up her support.
This is huge, because if we can do it here in Washington State, we can do it nationally, and then we've set the groundwork for doing it internationally.
The legislature is gridlocked, and the governor hasn't staked out a position, she says. Without strong state action, it will be up to the people to decide on the carbon tax come November. The tax may not be perfect, say supporters, but the ecological clock is ticking, and there's no time to lose. FSRN, Martha Baskin, Seattle.
A major coal exporter has dropped its bid to establish two coal export terminals on the Columbia River, but that doesn't mean government officials have. Lighthouse Resources announced Friday that the company was abandoning its fight to secure the right to ship coal to Asian markets from export terminals on the Columbia River in Boardman and Longview. Instead, the company, which mines upwards of 6 million tons of coal per year, will ship the coal from ports just south of Vancouver, BC, near the U.S. border. The prospective terminals in Oregon and Washington were met with fierce opposition and extensive publicity over the last several years. The permit for the Boardman project was denied by the state of Oregon in 2014, and an appeal to overturn the ruling was denied this year in the Oregon courts. Despite the announcement by Lighthouse Resources to abandon the Longview port, the coal export terminal continues to move toward approval, with several other coal exporters still on board, and the project receiving a favorable draft environmental impact statement from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
President Obama appeared at a student assembly at Benjamin Banneker Academic High School in Washington, D.C. to make this announcement.
We recently learned that America's high school graduation rate went up to 83%, which is the highest on record. That's good news. More African-American and Latino students are graduating than ever before. Right here in D.C., in just 5 years, the graduation rate in the District of Columbia public schools went from just 53% to 69%. So D.C.'s graduation rates grew faster than any other place in the country this past year, which is something to be really proud of.
According to the Department of Education, the high school graduation rate for the class of 2015 averaged 83.2% for all 50 states in the District of Columbia. That's an increase of nearly 1% from 2014. The state of Oregon's high school graduation rate is nearly 10% below average at 73.8% for the class of 2015, up from 72% the year before. Oregon's graduation hovered around 68% for the three previous years. Only the District of Columbia, Nevada, and New Mexico had lower graduation rates than Oregon. The state of Iowa had the nation's highest graduation rate in 2015, with over 90%.
And a cool way to stop warming the planet is now law. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water for October 16th, 2016.
A cool way to stop warming the planet. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
President Obama praised it, and Secretary of State John Kerry said it was monumental.
On Saturday, 170 nations reached a legally binding agreement to cut the use of a powerful global warming chemical that's commonly used in refrigerators and air conditioners.
Hydrofluorocarbons are a small part of greenhouse gas emissions, but are 1,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the Earth's atmosphere.
The agreement to eliminate HFCs was 7 years in the making and is expected to remove the equivalent of 70 billion tons of CO2. That's about twice the carbon pollution produced by the entire world in a year, according to the New York Times.
Officials from industry were at the meeting leading to the agreement and supported it, saying that they have already been working on developing replacement chemicals.
John Kerry told the BBC that the agreement will give us the opportunity to reduce the warming of the planet a half degree centigrade by the end of the century.
Hurricane Matthew devastated parts of Haiti on October 4th, killing an estimated 550 people. And now the country is just starting to come to grips with the damage done to its food production sector.
In various regions of Haiti, almost 100% of the crops and about half of the livestock were completely lost, according to the World Food Program. And the fishing industry has been paralyzed as equipment was washed away.
Some crops such as rice and vegetables may be replaceable faster than others, but fruit trees that had existed for generations will likely take a decade to recover.
After Matthew moved to the U.S., the hurricane had devastating effects on food production in North Carolina. Reuters reports that up to 5 million chickens and turkeys were killed on poultry farms in the southeast part of the state.
The governor of North Carolina said that nearly 5,000 hogs had been killed by the flooding, and one of the immediate problems was to bury them as soon as possible. But Rick Dove of Waterkeeper Alliance estimated that tens of thousands of hogs may still be in floodwaters.
There were also concerns about flooding of chicken and hog manure pits that store waste on farms. Flooded waste lagoons could contaminate rivers and water supplies for surrounding areas. Aerial photographs showed that some of the manure pools were completely underwater.
While activists were maintaining their protests at the Dakota Access Pipeline last week, other protesters took direct action against tar sands pipelines in four different states.
Early in the morning last Tuesday, activists cut padlocks and turned off valves at remote tar sands flow stations in Washington, Montana, North Dakota, and Minnesota.
Those pipelines carry crude produced from Canada's oil sands to the United States and have been fought for years by environmentalists.
Many of the activists who participated on Tuesday have been arrested. In addition, award-winning filmmaker Dea Schlossberg was charged with three counts of conspiracy for filming the North Dakota pipeline protest.
Various celebrities, including singer Neil Young and actor Mark Ruffalo, have called for the charges to be dropped against Schlossberg, saying that she was acting as a journalist.
Another documentary filmmaker, Lindsay Grazel, told Reuters that she was arrested in Washington State while filming the activists on Tuesday and said her footage was confiscated. She had not been charged as of Thursday afternoon.
Jay O'Hara, a spokesman for Direct Climate Action, said that the aim of the protest was to avert a climate change catastrophe which the planet is barreling toward without adequate public policy.
The energy used to pump, treat, and deliver water is significant, and it also contributes to global warming. Scientists have concluded that conserving water can lower greenhouse gas emissions from electricity generation.
A bill recently signed by California Governor Jerry Brown is focusing on the amount of electrical energy that is used by our water systems, from everything to delivering water to consumers, treating wastewater, and then disposing of it.
California water utilities will now voluntarily track the greenhouse emissions generated from their power use.
Frank Loge of the University of California, Davis, along with other researchers, has found that there is a significant amount of electricity saved through reducing urban water use.
In fact, during conservation efforts in 2015, the savings were roughly equivalent to the electricity conserved by the state's four major energy utilities that year.
Loge notes that making a connection between energy and water savings will also help persuade policymakers to fund more water conservation efforts.
In California, water utilities and wastewater treatment facilities use nearly 20% of the state's electricity supply, a number that could grow as the ongoing drought further stresses water supplies. And finally this week, Italy is famous for its fountains. Think the Trevi in Rome or Tivoli Gardens outside the city.
The Mediterranean nation is also famous for its wine.
And now it may be a huge travel destination for combining the two.
A fountain open to the public and flowing with red wine has appeared in the Abruzzo region just east of Rome, and it's free for the taking 24/7.
The Dora Sarchese Vineyard wanted to offer refreshment to the thousands of pilgrims who travel hundreds of miles to visit the local local cathedral, which keeps the remains of St. Thomas the Apostle.
But before you book your flight to party in Italy, the winery has a stern warning on its Facebook page that the fixture isn't for drunkards or louts.
And because it's gratis, no whining about having to bring your own gorgonzola and bread. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Looking for solutions to utility challenges? Get answers at AWWA's Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 30th through November 2nd. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Tensions in the Middle East remain extremely high as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart resumed talks in Europe over the weekend. No new ceasefire was agreed to, and fighting continued to rage in Aleppo, where several thousand rebels fighting the Syrian government remain in control of the town but are surrounded with supply lines cut off. Several hundred thousand civilians remain trapped without food and water between the government and rebel forces. The battle for Aleppo has reduced large areas of the city to rubble and is being called a humanitarian crisis. Fighting also increased rapidly over the weekend in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul, where government troops along with Kurdish forces are fighting to retake the town from so-called Islamic State rebels. Last Friday, President Obama met with military advisors to discuss a range of options regarding Russian support of the Syrian government. Direct military options against the Syrian government and its Russian allies were not approved. However, it was announced that the U.S. is considering ordering a cyber attack against Russia. The White House is also considering a call for further economic sanctions against Russia over its actions in Syria and its alleged hacking of the Democratic National Committee.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Anderson, Kyle Carrezzi, Don Zur, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News, H2O Radio, and Democracy Now! Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is me, Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show, Abe and Joe run down the ballot measures in the November election. At 9, on Alternative Radio, activist and consumer advocate Ralph Nader speaks on sovereignty of the people. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host D-May Roberts focuses on Milagro Theater's El Muerto Vagabundo, a Day of the Dead show about homelessness. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Andre Middleton interviews Portland painter Matthew Slim Pickens Abelman about art and satire. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support of KBOO Community Radio. Not a current member? Hey, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Lisa.
Good night, Ken.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Arrest and incarceration rates for women in the United States have climbed dramatically in the past few years. This past weekend, the Oregon Justice Research Center held its annual Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark College's School of Law to examine the impact of mass incarceration on women and how the Oregon's criminal justice system affects women. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh attended the conference and brings you this report.
I'm at the Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark College. It's put on by the Oregon Justice Resource Center. And here with me is Bobin Singh, the executive director of the OJRC. Bobin, this was a tremendous conference. Congratulations, first of all. Tell me about the conference in a nutshell.
Well, the conference in a nutshell, what we wanted to do is create a space to be able to talk about issues affecting women in the criminal justice system. This conference has been going on for over a decade. It was hosted in Eugene and primarily put on by a University of Law professor who's now retired. When we heard about the conference, it was something that we were excited about and, you know, attended. And it wasn't that big, primarily for, I think, the law school community down there. And when she was retiring, we knew that this was an important conversation to continue and wanted to continue to host the conference and moved it up here to Portland, where we've been able to increase the attendance over the past 4 years and began to really have a diverse audience that includes a significant number of formerly incarcerated women, service providers, attorneys, practitioners, volunteers that are able to come together, talk about issues that are directly impacting women who are intersecting with our criminal justice system.
It was incredibly moving, so many powerful, in talking to some of the people here attending, it's just been, it's heart-wrenching. I mean, it feels like sometimes the system is set up to make people fail. And the kinds of obstacles, and we hear complaints about two-thirds of people reoffending. With as much effort as the system puts into making people fail, it almost feels like getting one-third of people to not recidivate is against all odds. That's tremendous. If we would stop putting so many hurdles in place, but I'm the reporter, so I shouldn't be going on.
I think you're right. The system itself right now is designed to punish, overly incarcerate, and really, as we learned during the conference, the sentencing structure is